What I want to focus on today is in Parshas Mishpatim, we have the mention of Lo Sevashel Gedi B'Chalev Imo, which means that you are not allowed to cook meat and milk together. So let us get into a little bit of the highlights of Basar B'Chalev, of cooking Basar B'Chalev, and then into a discussion about waiting between meat and milk, which is, of course, a very relevant issue for many of us. So first of all, the Isser V'Heter, which is one of the most important Svarim on Hilchas Kashrus, on Isser V'Heter, it's called the Isser V'Heter, but it's all about Isser V'Heter, which is what is allowed, what perhaps is not allowed. He writes, Gadol Prishas Basar B'Chalev, staying away from Basar B'Chalev is so valuable, Shenemar, because it says when the Torah instructs us about Basar B'Chalev, Ki Am Kadosh Ata LaHashem Elokecha. If you are careful about Basar B'Chalev, then you will be considered the Am Kadosh LaHashem Elokecha. And therefore, says the Isser V'Heter, that is why it's very important. From the way that the Torah itself frames the prohibition of Basar B'Chalev, that is how we understand how much it plays a critical role in the Kedusha of the Jewish people. Now, what is the source that we're not allowed to have Basar B'Chalev? So we turn to a Pasuk that finds itself in Parshas Mishpatim, in our Parsha, finds itself once again in Parshas Kisisa, and the third time it comes up is in Parshas Re'eh. So the first one is in our Parsha. Reishis Bikuri Admascha Tavi Beis Hashem Elokecha. It says you have to bring your bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash, and then what seems to be a fragment of the pasuk that has no connection at all to the first part, we find the Torah then says, Lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo. You are not allowed to cook a mother with its milk. Okay, now that would seem to imply it's only prohibited if you have from the same family. And the Gemara gets into a discussion, how do we know that even if it's milk from a different cow or a different animal, and it's not the mother and the child, but this is the source. Then we have, once again, this is repeated in Parshas Kisisa, the same pasuk. Reishis Bikuri Admascha Tavi Beis Hashem Elokecha, Lo Sevashel Gedi B'Chalev Imo. And then number three, we find this a third time that it's mentioned in Sefer Dvarim in Parshas Re'eh, when the Torah says, Lo Sochlu Kol Nevela, you are not allowed to eat Nevela, La Gera Shebisharecha Titnenu Va'achala O Machar LaNachri. If you have non-kosher meat, Nevela means a piece of meat that was not shechted, that was not slaughtered properly. So, of course, we are not allowed to eat that. And the Torah ends off, Ki am kadosh ata la'ashem alokecha lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo. So we have the Gemara Maseches Chulin Kuftes Vav Amud Beis goes through a whole lengthy discussion. How do you know that you're not allowed to cook basar b'chalev? And the Gemara gives a whole bunch of different suggestions. But finally, the bottom line that the Gemara comes to is we learn it from these three times that the Torah mentions the prohibition. Lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo. Lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo. Lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo. What does it mean? Why would we have three instructions for the same thing? Says the Gemara, the first thing that it means is an isra achila. You're not allowed to eat basar b'chalev, which means if it was cooked together. Number two, it means an isra bishul. You're not allowed to cook basar b'chalev together, even if you don't end up eating it. So say, for example, I have a non-Jew who works in my house and I want to provide them lunch. I would not be allowed to cook basar b'chalev and then feed it to them, even though I know not to eat it. And there's a big sign over it that says, non-kosher, don't get near it. Still, I'm not allowed to cook it. That is a separate, independent prohibition. And number three, I'm not allowed to have hana. I'm not allowed to derive benefit from basar b'chalev either. So say, for example, let's say I have, I don't know what the arrangement is. If you have a cleaning personnel in your house and you are expected to give them breakfast and lunch, let's say. So now that I give them lunch, what am I going to feed them? So we just said, I'm not allowed to cook them basar b'chalev. What if somebody drops off at my house a sandwich of basar b'chalev, and then I say, hey, thank you so much, I really appreciate it, I can't eat it, but I'm going to give it to the person who works in my house. The answer is, you wouldn't be allowed to do that. Why not? I'm not eating it, I'm not cooking it, but I'm deriving benefit. How am I deriving benefit? How am I having hana? Because I would have had to pay $5 or $10 to go out and buy a sandwich for this person. And instead of spending the money, I now get benefit from the basar b'chalev that somebody else dropped off a basar b'chalev sandwich in my house. I know that I can't eat it, so I give it to the non-Jew who's working in my house, who I had an obligation to provide services for. I had to give them breakfast or lunch. So therefore, I am now violating the issur, the prohibition of basar b'chalev, of having hana from basar b'chalev. So those are the three prohibitions that we are familiar with. Any math people in the room? No? Not really. Yes? Okay, it's not such complicated math. The Balaturim, often on Chumash, has gematrias and different things. So this is just a nice one if you want to keep track of it. He says, Lo Sevashel, which is the prohibition that we're talking about here. And we just said, Lo Sevashel means you're not allowed to cook, you're not allowed to eat, and you're not allowed to have benefit. So he says, Los of Ashel is a gematria 763. Check that up later. And he says, that is the same numerical value as Iser Achila Ubishel Vehana. What that does for your Yiddishkeit, I don't know. But I thought it was a fascinating gematria that is quoted by the Baal HaTurim. And the Baal HaTurim was one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, one of the most important of the Rishonim. And we follow the tour on so many different areas of halacha. So fascinating to be aware of the gematria that he came up with. So there is a big discussion in general about many of the mitzvahs haTorah, whether we say that darshin on time of the Kra or lor darshin on time of the Kra. What does that mean? So it's really the most important place. Oh, this is your thesis? Yours. Here we go. Here we go. Are you even in this class?
No.
No.
You're meeting about your thesis right now.
Exactly. Here we go. We had a meeting officially. So, darshin on time of the Kra, lo darshin on time of the Kra. Let's see how much you know about the topic. Where is the most important Gemara about darshin on time of the Kra? You're not up to there yet?
Not enough. I just listened to one here so far.
Don't listen to a shir. The most important Gemara source of darshin on time of the Kra is in Maseches Bava Metzia, where the Gemara has the following discussion. The Gemara wants to know, we're told that when you have an almana, and you lend money to an almana. So it says, lo sachbo beged almana. What does that mean, lo sachbo beged almana? It means, if I lend somebody money, I want to take a collateral that I know I'm going to be paid back. Now, how am I supposed to know? So, if I lend you money, I take your watch. Your watch is very valuable to you. Your diamond ring, chani, is very valuable. So I take it and I say, listen, I'm happy to lend you the money, but I want to hold on to something to make sure that I'm going to get the money back. And when you pay me back, I'll give you back the collateral. Says the Gemara, that's all fine when you're dealing with a certain class of people. If you're dealing with an almana, if you're dealing with a woman who lost her husband, lo sachbo beged almana. Do not take the beged, the clothing of an almana, as a collateral when you give her a loan. Now what does it mean? Take the clothing of an almana? Why would I take the clothing of an almana? So what's the answer? What? It's all she has. When I'm dealing with most other people, so I'm not going to take your clothing as a collateral. I'm going to take your diamond ring. I'll take your whatever. I'll take something else that's valuable to you. I'll take your computer. When you're dealing with an almana who's borrowing money, she doesn't have anything. So what can she give you? All she can give you is her clothing. Says the Torah, you can't take her clothing. So what does that mean? She's going to walk around without clothing? What does it even mean? So the Gemara says, no. Here's the story. The story is, she probably has one sweater and one dress that she wears during the day. And then at night she goes to sleep and wears pajamas. So what am I going to do? Every morning I'm going to go and take her pajamas that she uses in the middle of the night. I'm going to use that as the collateral. Then when it comes time for her to take a shower and go to sleep at night, I'm going to go back to the house and say, okay, you can have the pajamas back, but give me the clothing that you wore today. So this is what we're going to do. Says the Gemara, how's that going to look? That every day Shechter is walking over to the Almana's house in the morning as she's about to get out of her pajamas. Hi, I'm here with your clothing. And she has to hide behind the door, get all undressed, give me the pajamas, I'm going to have to hand her back. It's crazy. And then at night, I'm going to... So even though there's nothing officially inappropriate going on, but it would seem to be a very inappropriate thing to do. And therefore, the Torah says, lo sachbo beged almana. If you give money to an almana as a loan, you're not allowed to do that. You can't take her one article of clothing because it's going to be motzei rav b'shchein oseh. Everyone's going to start saying, hey, there's something very strange going on here. Why is he always at the door when she's getting dressed? Why is she always handing him the clothing? Something's not right. Okay. Says the Gemara, what's the halacha if I have an almana who is a rich businesswoman? And she has a house, and she has an estate, and she has a car, and she has a computer, and she has everything. And when I lend her money for a business dealing, if I lend her money, she wants to then give me her computer or her car as a collateral, just as any other business associate would. Says the Gemara, this is the discussion of darshinan taima dekra. Do I have a right to delve deeper into the reasoning behind the mitzvah? Obviously, the reason behind this mitzvah is because it's not appropriate that I should be in this kind of strange relationship with this woman that I'm going to keep passing the clothing back and forth. But if you have a woman who has everything, and there's going to be nothing strange about it at all, she's giving me a collateral like any other business associate would, so why shouldn't I be allowed to do it? That is the general discussion of darshinan taima dekra. Do we have a right to learn the reasoning for the mitzvah and then to determine that the halacha should be different based on that reasoning? Or do you say, no, if the Torah says don't do it, don't do it, irrespective of what you think the reasoning is or is not? Okay? Say for another example. Torah says, Va'ata kislu lachemas hashira azos. The final mitzvah of the 613 mitzvahs is You have to write a Sefer Torah. Every Jew has a mitzvah to write their own Sefer Torah. Sounds great. What are we going to do with the Sefer Torah? What's the point? We should just have a museum piece in our houses? I don't want to take out insurance for a Sefer Torah in my house, so why should I have a Sefer Torah? The answer is, because if I have a Sefer Torah, I'm going to be able to teach the Torah to my children. If I don't have a text, I can't teach it. So says the Rush. How much does a Sefer Torah cost to write your own Sefer Torah? Cost $50,000, $100,000, whatever it's going to cost you. It's a lot of money. Says the Rush. Is that really the way we teach our children today? Nobody who teaches their children goes to shul, takes out a Sefer Torah, and then teaches their kids from the Torah itself. What do? You buy a Chumash, you buy a set of Tanakh, you buy a Mishnayis, you buy a Gemara, you buy a Mishnah Berurah, you have a Shulchan Aruch, you have all these things. That's the way we educate our children. So what does it mean when it says that I should write a Sefer Torah? Says the Rush, since the whole reason for the mitzvah is that I should be able to teach my children the Torah and perpetuate the values of Torah to them, then it would make more sense nowadays that nobody learns from the Torah itself to buy svarim. And that would be the way to fulfill the mitzvah. So this is a very important question in general. Do we go beneath the surface of the mitzvah and try to understand the reasoning and then come to new conclusions based on the reasoning? Or would you say, no, if the Torah says do X, then that's what you do, irrespective of any reason. It is not dependent on any reasoning. It's just an independent mitzvah as is, and you don't have a right to make the terms of the mitzvah based on the reasoning that you think it applies to. So here is a big discussion in the Rishonim. Where does this whole idea come from? Why would we tell people that they should be discouraged from eating basar b'chalav? What does God care if I eat meat and milk, as long as it's kosher? What's the issue? I have kosher meat, I have kosher milk. Why does it make a difference? So the Rambam in the Mor Nebuchim is very bothered by this, trying to understand what is the time of the Korah? What is the reasoning behind this instruction of not eating basar b'chalav? It comes up, as we said, three different times in the Torah. So obviously it's very important, but why? What is this? So the Rambam says perhaps the reason is because this is the way the Umas HaOlam, the nations of the world, used to service their gods. They used to go and cook basar b'chalav together and eat it. And because this is reminiscent of the way that their service went, therefore we try to stay very far away from pagan services, pagan sacrifices, and that's why the Torah instructs us as a harchaka, as a way to keep you very far away from getting anywhere near those kinds of practices or behaviors. The Torah says, don't ever eat basar b'chalav, don't cook basar b'chalav, don't have anah from basar b'chalav, stay very far away from it. Says the Rambam, that is the way to understand it. Now, where did he get this idea from? Where did he get this idea from? Says the Rambam, perhaps the reason why is because you will notice that the Torah, if you look in the Psukim, the Torah puts right next to the prohibition of eating basar b'chalav, the Torah talks about the mitzvah of Shalosh Pa'amim Bashana Yira'eh Kol Zechurcha. It says you're supposed to go to the Beis HaMikdash and do Aliyah L'Regel. Says the Rambam, why does the Torah put those two things together? Why does the Torah talk about visiting the Beis HaMikdash and don't eat basar b'chalav? What do they have to do with each other? The answer is, what the Torah is emphasizing is, when the pagans go to their temples and they service their gods, they are very involved in basar b'chalav. When you are going to the Beis HaMikdash to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, make sure you do not get near basar b'chalav. That's the way the Rambam understands what the prohibition is all about. Okay? Chani, is that helpful? Very helpful. Okay. So that's what the Rambam says. There are others who explain differently. The Ramban writes in his commentary on Chumash and Sefer Devarim. Again, as we mentioned, this shows up in three different places. So the Ramban there in Sefer Devarim, Parashas Re'eh, writes that the reason for this is because the Torah is trying to teach us a general sensitivity. Is it sensitive? Is it sensitive to go and slaughter a animal and cook it in the baby's milk? And cook the meat of this child in its mother's milk. That would be something that is extremely insensitive. So says the Ramban, the Torah is trying to teach us sensitivities. And therefore the Torah says, don't ever cook meat together with its mother's milk. And in doing so, we then extend it further to even a non-mother and child. We just say that this is a way to train ourselves to be sensitive across the board and not to do anything that is insensitive, especially to other human beings. So that's the way the Ramban explains it. Along comes Ravena Bechaya in our parsha, if you look at number above, and he says, what are you talking about? Min hanira ki atamim ha'ele bilti maspikim. I appreciate the Ramban very much, and I respect him. And I know that the Ramban and the Sefer HaChinuch and the Kli Yakar and everybody on their commentaries on Chumash has their own reasons to explain what the origins of basar b'chalav are all about. Says Ravena Bechaya, but none of them add up. Einam ikar b'tam ha'mitzvah, ela lidchos es ha'shoel. All the Rambam was trying to do is, he probably had some nudnik, says the Rabbeinu Bechaya, somebody who was bothering him, badgering him, and asking him, what's Basar B'Chalav all about? Can you explain this to me? I'm not going to keep Basar B'Chalav if I don't understand it. So the Rambam came up, Lidchos HaShoa, to quiet down the person who was questioning him, who was badgering him about Basar B'Chalav. He came up with a reason. But says the Rabbeinu Bechaya, Hare mitzvah zu mechlala chukim hi. What do you mean? This mitzvah is a chok, which means there is no way to fully understand what Basar B'Chalav is about. You're going to get into the Ribono Shel Olam's brain and try to figure out why it is. You're going to superimpose your own logic onto his mitzvahs and say, this is why it happened. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Bechaya, he stands by his principle, which is, this is one of the mitzvahs that is in the category of chok, and there is no way to explain rationally why it is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have instructed us to be careful about Basar B'Chalav. Now, yeah.
How does the Ramban explain Shiloh HaKam that, or something else that wouldn't seem to be
sensitive at all?
Yeah.
They explain it the other way. Shiloh HaKam, they say, is very sensitive because it wouldn't be nice to take the chicks, to take the eggs away when the mother was there. You have to send away the mother to make sure you're being sensitive.
What about other examples?
Yeah, so you have to look through. The Rishonim do deal with many, many of the mitzvahs HaTorah and try to figure out why, you know, how, why there is a time of the, like, is there a reason for it? What's the purpose of it? But that's a big question. So in last week's Parsha, and then once again in this week's Parsha, we have the story, the mention of Kabbalah HaTorah. Of course, the most important place where it is Parshas Yisro, which happens to fascinate me very much. Why does it show up in the one Parsha in the Torah that is named after a non-Jew, Yisro? Right, we talk about Kabbalah HaTorah, which is the most defining moment of the Jewish people. Why does it go in the name of Yisro? I don't know. Not the kind of thing I've spent too much time thinking about, but something I do notice every year and wonder what it's all about. So, Parshas Mishpatim also has a mention of Kabbalah HaTorah once again. And there's a fascinating Medrash. If you look here in the Medrash Shochar Tov, we don't have to read through the whole thing, but you may want to read it on your own because it's very, very fascinating. The Medrash says, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to give the Torah at Har Sinai, so we're familiar that the Gemara tells us that he went to all the Umas HaOlam, he went to all the nations of the world, and he asked them if they want to take the Torah, and each one had a reason why they didn't want it. But the Medrash fills us in to another detail. It's not just that he went to the Umas HaOlam, it's before he even did that, the Malachi Asharis, the angels in heaven, came to the Ribono Shel Olam and said, why would you give the Torah to human beings? Ma enosh kisis gerena, they're just human beings. What do you mean? We're angels. Keep the Torah here in heaven. Why would you go down and basically defile the Torah by giving it to the Jewish people? And although the Jewish people may be wonderful, but they're not malachim, they're not angels, so why would you give it to the human beings that live on this earth? This was the discussion back and forth, and if you look through this whole medrash here, you will see what all the arguments back and forth were. Fine. In the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to them and he says, listen, I know we're arguing back and forth, but in the end, I'm giving the Torah to the Jewish people. And they say, yeah, but the Jewish people are going to do things wrong. He told them lo sirtzach, he told them lo sinach, he told them lo sigzol, and they're going to end up violating it. Human beings have all kinds of evil inclinations. They're not going to be good. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns back to all of them and says, really, can I point out a time in history when you did something terrible? When you did not follow the laws of the Torah? So when was that? When was that? Nobody knows. When was the time in history that the human beings, I'm sorry, that the angels, Malachi Hashari, seems to have done something wrong? Yeah?
When they ate meat and milk with Avram.
So they ate meat and milk with Avram. What does it say over there? By Avram Avinu it says, Vayikach chema v'chalav u'ben ha-bakar asher asa. It says Avram Avinu took cheese and milk and he prepared the meat, and he served it to the malachim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to them, you did something wrong with Basar B'Chalav, and therefore you are not entitled to the Torah. Don't have a claim against the Jewish people that they're going to mess up. They're not going to follow the laws of the Torah. What about you? And that was the winning argument. Because of that, Malachi Asharis had to release their grip on the Torah, and it was then given to the Jewish people. Fine, that's the end of the story. Again, you can read the whole Medrash here inside and understand what it's all about. A lot of fascinating points to think about there. The Berhetiv actually writes that this is why the Minhag developed that on Shavuos we have Milchix and we have Fleishix. The reason why is because on Shavuos we want to remind ourselves, why were we worthy of getting the Torah in the first place? It's only because the Malachi Asharis didn't do it right when it came to the meat and milk. And we want to show we can do it right. we can eat milk, we can eat meat on the same day, and we can do it properly. And it's because of that that we got the Torah, says the Berahitev. That's the reason why we have a custom, why we have a practice in many of our communities to have milk and meat, obviously not together, but to have two separate meals on Shavuos, to highlight the fact that that is the winning argument that got us the Torah in the first place. Now, the Chanukah Satorah, which is a sefer written by the Shach, I'm sorry, by the Rebbe of Heschel, who is a Rebbe of the Shach. The Shach is one of the most important poskim in Shulchan Aruch on Yerodeah. So the Rebbe of the Shach was the Chanukah Satorah. And the Chanukah Satorah says, I don't understand. You're angry at the Malachi Hasharis that they ate Basar B'chalav. No. And that's why you're going to say, human beings deserve the Torah because they're better than you. Because human beings didn't mess up with Basar B'chalav. No, what's the obvious question? What do you say? Avram didn't eat with them, but what did Avram do?
Well, he gave it to them.
He gave to them. How did he give it to them?
He cooked it.
He cooked it. Cooking Basar B'chalav is the same prohibition as eating Basar B'chalav. So why are you angry at the Malachi Asharis for eating the Basar B'chalav? What about Avram Avinu, who obviously cooked the Basar B'chalav? Why didn't the angels respond that, what are you, hey, slow down. We were visiting Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu is the one who cooked the Basar B'chalav, and then we just went along with it and we ate it. That's the question that the Chanukah Satara asked. Such an obvious question, no? You're laughing because it's so obvious. Or it's so interesting.
All of you.
Or neither. You're just laughing at me. That's fine. So there are a lot of very fascinating possibilities. I'm joking. Just take it easy. A lot of very fascinating possibilities that are given in the Gemara to understand, I'm sorry, in the later Svarim, to try to understand what this is all about. The most fascinating to me is the stipler. The stipler writes in a Sefer Kilas Yaakov, I'm sorry, in a Sefer on Chumash called Birchas Peretz, he writes, perhaps the answer is that Avraham Avinu prepared basar and chalav. He put it out on the table. That's not a prohibition midaraisa at all. That's okay. But since the Malachi Asharis are made out of Eish, so then automatically when they started to eat it, it got cooked inside of them. So Avraham Avinu didn't violate anything when he prepared it. He just put cheese on the table, milk on the table, and meat on the table. Once the Malachi Asharis started swallowing everything, now that became a problem. All right, interesting. A lot to talk about there, just something to think about. But again, what's clear is the Gemara tells us that there's an Isser Achila Basar B'chalav. You're not allowed to eat Basar B'chalav, and that is learned from the Gemara in Maseches Chulin Kuftas Vavim Beis that says, from the three times that it says, Lo Sevashel Gedi B'chalav Imo. And that is the concluding psak of the Gemara. That is the source of which we learn this prohibition. That is the way the Rambam understands it. Rashi and Chumash writes that. The Rashba, the Mechaber, the Chachmas Adam, all of the great poskim learn it from the same place. And as we said, there's a prohibition of Bishul, there's a prohibition of Hanah, and all of those are subsumed under this general limud that the Gemara has from Lo Sevashel Gedi B'chalev Imo. Okay, now, that includes not only cooking Basar B'chalev, it also includes baking or frying Basar B'chalev. All of those are included in this prohibition. The question then became, in more recent times, what about using a microwave? Is a microwave considered to be Bishul or not? Now, what does it matter if it's Bishul? Something gets hot, that's all that matters to me. The answer is, of course it matters. If there's a prohibition of cooking Basar B'chalev and somebody throws milk and meat into the microwave, would they be in violation of Bishul Basar B'chalev or not? Take, for example, what about Shabbos? It says that there's a prohibition of Bishul B'Shabbos. What if I put something in the microwave? Now, how are you going to press the buttons and how are you going to turn it on? It's a separate question, but let's say you somehow get around that. What are you going to do about the fact that it gets cooked on Shabbos? Is that considered a malacha of Bishul B'Shabbos? What does the Gemara say? Hamavashel l'chame tiberia. Bishul b'chama. Let's say I'm in the Sahara Desert. Boiling hot. I don't know what the temperature is over there, but I assume it's hot. So it's very hot. Sorry, this is really annoying me. So it's very hot. And I decide I'm going to try something. Is that better? I decide I'm going to try something. So I take an egg. I crack the egg on the windshield of my car, and the egg cooks from the beating hot sun. So am I in violation of Bishul B'Shabbos? No, why not? It's nothing. Nobody cooks that way. That's not normal. So the Gemara says it's not Derech Bishul. In order to violate the Malach of Bishul B'Shabbos, I have to do something that's normal. So what about a microwave? Now it's normal. So does that change it? So let's see. Look at the Beis Yitzchak. That's Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkish in Europe, one of the great Gedolim. He writes here a number of tests. If you look at the end, he tells us, Pashut, the Mevashel B'Shabbos Ayidei Chamimus V'Shalheves Hamishave Ayidei Koach HaElectricity. Better known to us as a microwave. So if I heat something up on Shabbos, if I cook something on Shabbos with electricity, which means with a microwave, O Mevashel B'Shabbos B'Chalav Ayidei Koach Zeh, or instead of talking about cooking on Shabbos, but I talk about cooking Basar b'chalav, which also is a prohibition of bishul. Va'af shelo nechal be'ha'avara kazu shum eitz shuman kamo b'havaras dvarim ha'omd in the sreifa. He says, even though this fire is not hot enough to, let's say, to heat up a piece of wood, of course I wouldn't be able to burn a piece of wood in the microwave. I can put it in, but it's not going to work. So he says, it's true. The microwave is not going to get hot like some of the other things that can hot. But still, he says, o mevashel basar b'chalav ayidei koach zeh, Kiven Shanir Le Inenu Shalheves, Havi Mevashal Ve'esh V'chai Mishum Shabbos, O Mishum Mevashal Basar V'chalav. He says that this would be something that would be considered Bishul Basar V'chalav, and we would assume that that would be considered an Isser D'Oraisa. And the Talmidim of Rav Moshe Feinstein write the same thing, that cooking in a microwave either on Shabbos or during the week using Basar V'chalav would be something that would probably be prohibited. Now, there is a big discussion about, my father quotes in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, what happens, anybody here in, go to science labs? Anybody here in, what?
Unfortunately.
What do you plan to go for?
Something
real. So then it's not unfortunately, it's a good thing.
Yeah, you're right.
You have to go to labs. I don't want a doctor who doesn't know what's going on in the lab. So it's a good thing. So Rav Soloveitchik said that his brother was actually a chemist. Rav Soloveitchik's brother, Shmuel Soloveitchik, was a professor in YU. He was the Rav's older brother, I think. So he was a brilliant man, and he was a professor of physics or some kind of science, something. And the question came up, would there be a prohibition of Bishul Basar V'Chalav if you're doing it just to learn about chemical reactions? Right? So he asked Rav Soloveitchik this. Of course, when we say there's an Isser of cooking, this is what they spoke about around the dinner table. It's not what we talk about.
Another class.
What?
I would have done another class this week, so it's like...
This?
Yeah.
The same issue?
Yeah.
Who brought it up?
My friend.
And what did he say?
He said it wasn't a problem because it wasn't official with the intention of Achim.
Right. So what's interesting is Rav Soloveitchik says that there's no problem in that case to heat up two items together, a basar and chalav, and then to have them cook together, because that is not with the intention of ultimately eating it. And since these three prohibitions really are derived from the same words, lo savashal, lo savashal, lo savashal, so maybe it means there's some connection between bishul and achila. So if I'm just heating this up to see the chemical reaction and not to ultimately have someone eat it, maybe there would be no prohibition at all. That's what he said. That's not so pashut. It's not so simple. The Sefer Achinuch writes, when he describes the Isra Bishul Basar V'Chalav, tell Rabbi Fine, Mitzvah Tzadi Beis, the Sefer Achinuch writes that he's not so sure about that. And it would seem that even if you have no intention to eat it at all, and you have no intention to give it to a non-Jew to eat, you're doing it only because you want to learn about the chemical reaction, perhaps that would be a problem regardless, and that would be an issue either way. Anyway, very interesting point. There is a discussion about what happens when, let's say, I go to, it's a similar discussion. There are those who are, very super frum. So they're very nervous about meat and milk. So, of course, we should be careful about meat and milk in our homes. And we should make sure that we have a kosher home, and we should know the laws of kashrus. But do you think that there's any expectation that I have to have a milchik garbage can and a fleshy garbage can? You're laughing because you think so? Your aunt would do. I think it's something a lot of our aunts would do. And the question is there anything to it? So I once went to someone's house and I saw there were like garbage cans everywhere. So I said, what's going on? They said, well, these are milchik, these are fleshik. I'm like, really? You need separate garbage cans? Like, what happens if they go together? Like, well, it's basar b'chalav. So I'm thinking, like, it's basar b'chalav. What does that even mean? It's like, basar b'chalav, the prohibition is to cook basar b'chalav together. I said, well, what's going to happen if when I'm spilling out the leftovers from the pot of the gravy that I just finished making and there's some cheese that's left over from the lunch that I threw out when I was making my grilled cheese, it's going to be Bishul Basar V'Chalav in the garbage can. Nu, so what do you say? What do you say about that? First of all, a little far-fetched. that it just so first. Here's the first of all. I get the second of all. The first of all is how often. I don't spend enough time in the kitchen to know the answer to this, but how often do you take your boiling hot gravy that is still sizzling hot, that is able to then cook a piece of cheese? When was the last time you went to the garbage can, correct me if I'm wrong, and you took that and poured it into the garbage? What do you say, Shangel? Never did that. Anyone else ever did that? What if the gravy came out looking horrible? Would you wait for it to cool off a little first? Nope. Anybody?
Yeah, it would burn the bag.
Exactly. It would burn the bag. So that's first of all. What are the chances that you're going to put something in there that is so hot that it's going to be able to cook the cheese that's in there? Second of all, what is the likelihood that even the person who decides to do that and not worry about burning the bag and be oblivious to that fact is going to do it right after they had a grilled cheese sandwich in the morning for lunch, and now this is going to turn out to be Bishul Basar Mechalav? Sounds very unlikely to me. Third of all, we'll get to your question in a minute. Third of all, when I'm doing this, I'm being mevashel. Let's say you're that person that doesn't care to burn through the bag. You're also that person that has grilled cheese for lunch every day. So you have a number of strikes against you. And now, when you throw it out in the garbage, do you have any intention to cook that? It's holech le'ibud. It's going to the garbage. So why don't you think about the following? Some communities, you ever go away in the summertime or whenever you go away, and instead, like, there's no garbage pickup. You have to bring your garbage to a communal dumpster or something or whatever. So what happens there? Some of them, you just throw it in, and then some company comes and brings it, you know, whatever. Some of them, you put it in, and I assume there's some incinerator inside that's going to burn all the garbage. And
we have one in our building.
Oh, so how do you ever, you have an incinerator in your building?
Maybe,
okay.
Maybe it's a crusher.
Okay, how do you ever throw a bag of garbage into the incinerator? Maybe the person right on top of you just threw out their milchig leftovers from dinner. Now you're going to throw out your burning hot fleishig leftovers, and now you're going to crush the button for the incinerator, and it's going to now burn everything together and be mevashe basar mechalav. Does that sound like a likely problem for you? Why are you not concerned about it? Do you not worry about basar mechalav?
It's not for eating.
It's not for eating.
It's not.
So it's more than that. I think it's more than that. Again, the case before that not for eating was questionable. When you're doing a scientific experiment and you're mixing basar mechalav because you want to see the chemical reaction of the two items and materials together, that's a question. That the Sefer HaChinuch says he's not so sure of. Soloveitchik said that wouldn't even be Bishul Basar Mechalav. But even if you would say that would be considered Bishul Basar Mechalav, this is so many steps more removed. Why? Because this is Holech Le'ibud. This is going to go in the garbage. It's not. I'm not even interested in the chemical reaction. I have no interest in what's happening. I don't even know that it's happening. So that cannot be defined as Bishul Basar Mechalav. And that is why many say that there is no reason, even your aunt does not have to have her double garbage cans in the kitchen. And that is also why Rav Asher Weiss once told me that someone asked him a shaila whether he has to make sure that he has, one second, what do you want to know? He has to make sure that he has two different sreifas chametz on Erev Pesach. One for milchiks and one for fleishiks. So, come on. So one for milk is one for fleishig. So Rav Asher Weiss told me, it's holech le'ibud. I'm throwing it into the fire and it's all being burnt up. So if somebody else comes with a grilled cheese sandwich and I come with my piece of meat, first of all, why are you burning a piece of meat? It's not chametz. But even if you are, what's the concern? What's going to happen? So he felt that that svar of holech le'ibud is something that we don't have to be concerned about. Yeah? Someone had a question? Yeah?
I'm gifted a cheeseburger. Can I give it to a homeless person?
That is an excellent question. If I am gifted a cheeseburger is real basar mechalav because it's cooked together. It's not just, like, let's say sometimes you go to a store and they have cold meat, right? They have deli and they have slices of cheese. That's not the biblical prohibition of basar mechalav because it's not cooked together. So that's not what you're asking. A cheeseburger, I assume the cheese is actually melted because it's from either because it's in the oven together or it gets heated from the burger, which is so hot. So now you have real basar mechalav. So yeah?
Isn't the meat not kosher though?
Correct, the meat is not kosher. Ein iser chalal iser, big discussion. But let's leave that aside for a minute. You have a kosher meat that had cheese on top of it, and now it's real basar mechalav. Good? For argument's sake. Unlikely case, but let's say, argument's sake. So you get a cheeseburger. Someone is very nice enough, gives it to you. Now what do you do with it? So, to give it to a friend, what do you say? No, why not?
Because that then they owe you something.
Then they owe you something, correct. That would be a violation of an Isser Hana. Because if I'm giving my friend something, they're going to feel the need next time around to give me something. So I'm not allowed to do that. To give it to a homeless person is a great example. I'm never going to see this person again. With my contributions to this person, they're going to get off the streets. Right? They're going to put their lives back together. And they're going to get off the streets. So I think that that sounds like something that you might be able to do. I like that. It's a good example.
What about the day for Hefker? Like, let's say there's a Hefker table at work. Like, everyone leaves their extra food. Would that be allowed?
Yeah, nobody's going to know it's you. Yeah. Is there such a concept, or that's like a Jewish thing? Like a Hefker table at work? It sounds nice, but I'm curious if such a thing exists.
My mom has one at her work, and
yeah?
It's not Jewish.
And everyone just drops off things?
Yeah.
Really?
All the time.
And everyone trusts each other that, like, there's no poison in the cake?
I mean, she's never had a problem, but she's also never eaten from it. So
okay, so I guess we would know if there was a problem. Okay. Any other questions? One final issue about Bishul Basar B'Challav, which I think is very, very important, is what about cleaning towels together in the washing machine? So, of course, bath towels and hand towels are not a problem. But sometimes in the kitchen, you have a big gravy spill, right? So instead of taking a whole roll of paper towels, you just take a hand towel and you put it on the ground and you clean everything up. No, Shani? Okay. Now, tomorrow, my child is eating his breakfast, and of course, he turns his bowl upside down, forgot about the laws of gravity, and the milk is all over the floor. So I have, of course, not the towel from last night's dinner, that's already in the washing machine, but I have the towel now that I'm going to clean up the milk with, and I throw it into the machine. I'm like, oh, now there's two towels in there, let me just turn on the machine. Oh, turn on the machine! Bishul Basar B'Challav! No? About the bashishim of what? The water?
Yeah.
Let's say I have 10 towels with all the gravy that I spilled all over the place, right? Bitul b'shishim is very nice, except when you get into the issue of bitul iser l'chatchila. So am I allowed to do that or not? Okay, complicated. Good question. Yeah?
It's not going to get hot enough.
Why not?
A washing machine.
Washing machine is not hot water?
To cook meat, it's not going to get hot enough.
Why not?
It's not, it's like temperature-wise to cook
how meat. How hot does a washing machine get on a hot cycle?
Not hot enough to make the inside of a piece of meat 145 degrees.
130 degrees Fahrenheit.
What is
wow.
That,
rare? Wow, it's impressive.
According to Google.
That's how hot a dish,
washing machine
gets.
It's like close to like the official number. Close?
That's pretty close.
Is it like natural?
That's in the range.
Isn't that also technically called that's what you would? Like,
yes. Yes, it is.
Soaked.
It's just an interesting issue to think about. Yes, you have a question?
Yeah, is there ever
Ein Basar B'Challav, Achar Basar B'Challav?
Achar Bishul.
I don't know. I have to look it up again. But in general, I think we generally assume... 1 minute. A piece of cheese is always cooked. Right?
Pasteurized.
Of course. Right? It's cooked. So you take a piece of cheese. Yeah. Bishul Basar B'Challav. If you take, even a cooked piece of meat and a cooked piece of cheese, and you cook them together, that's a problem. Yeah. Never thought about it, but yes. Yeah.
So what's the halacha with washing things together?
I don't think it's a problem. I don't think it's a problem because again, you have no kavana levashel. You have no intention for anything that's coming out. It's holich le'ibud, right? The point of putting it in the washing machine is that everything should be extracted from the towel, not that it should cook together and then you'll take it out and have a beautiful sandwich. That's not the plan. Yeah?
But doesn't that lose its status as like food in the first place when soap gets on? Because then it's clean.
Yes, so it's a good question. What about the soap that goes in? That should also be a consideration here. Yeah, a lot of things. For a lot of reasons, it's not, it's usually not assumed to be a problem. Okay? Good, now we continue. So the Isser Minat Torah, the biblical prohibition of Basar B'Challav means I'm not allowed to take meat and milk and cook them together. I'm not allowed to take that which was cooked together and then eat it, or that which was cooked together and then have benefit from it. Midrabbanan, on a rabbinic level, they came up with extra extensions of this prohibition as well. And they said, not only are you not allowed to cook them together and then eat them together after they were cooked, but you're also not allowed to have meat and milk eaten at the same table at the same time, the Shulchan Aruch writes. So if you're eating meat and I'm eating milk, we should not be sitting at the same table unless there is some kind of very recognizable hecker in between us, unless there is some kind of recognizable separation. So for example, if we want to eat at the same table and I have that underneath my food and you have something else, then we assume that that would be okay. I go to Camp Simcha in the summer, and this comes up every summer in Camp Simcha. The reason why is because, anyone here been to camp? Yeah? So you know what I'm talking about? We were there together?
Probably.
Yeah?
2021.
I was there. Okay. So, in Camp Simcha, they try to make accommodations for many different types of campers who are there. And some of them have very specific diet requirements because of the treatments that they're having. But they want to still allow them to have the experience of sitting together with everyone else. They don't want to single them out. So when we're serving, let's say, meat at a meal, and somebody has to have dairy because they're not, whatever, they're, for whatever reason, they're unable to have meat, we want them to still be able to sit with all their friends. So the question is, what can we make for them to be able to sit at the same table together with everyone else? So what we instituted was that we're going to have special placemats that are made that are going to be placed under the one who is going to have the unusual meal. Now, of course, that continues to single them out and make them feel a little bit different, but still, at least you get to sit around with everyone else and you don't have to sit in a secluded dining room isolated by yourself. So the Shulchan Aruch says, we have a prohibition to eat meat and milk at the same table even though I'm not cooking them together. And what's the prohibition all about? The prohibition is, we're such good friends, you never know, maybe I'm going to stick my hand over into your plate and eat something from your plate. Now, if you're a mufunak like me, I would never stick my hands into anyone's plate. I don't care how close I am with them, it's disgusting. To put your hands into someone else's plate and eat it, maybe it means you put a fork in, I don't know. But the concern is maybe you're going to eat someone else's food while they're in the middle of eating, and since you're eating meat and they're eating milk, you're going to come to eat basar and chalav at the same time. That is why we have a prohibition, which is why if you're sitting together with someone who you would never, ever put your hands into their food, right? So say, for example, you're sitting at work, and sometimes at work they have these, you know, large stations where everyone just comes and sits and eats, and you're not even paying attention to each other. You're just sitting at the large open public area, which is the cafeteria. There's no concern that maybe I'm going to turn to my friend who I don't even know, and I'm going to stick my hands into their food. Eino makiro. I have no relationship with you. I would never do that. If I would do it, I would probably get arrested. So we would assume that that would not be a prohibition in that situation, but if you're sitting with someone who you're friendly with, that would be something that certainly needs to be avoided. So that is one extension that we find in the Shulchan Aruch about this prohibition of basar b'chalav. It applies not only to cooking basar b'chalav together, not only to eating cooked basar b'chalav together, but even when one person is eating meat and then the other person is eating milk. The third extension that we find to this prohibition is another issur d'rabbanan, which means that you're not allowed to have meat and milk within a certain time frame of one another. Even though they weren't cooked together, still we assume that I have to refrain from having meat and milk one after the other, and the person has to be concerned about it. Where does this all come from? So the Gemara says in Maseches Chulin Daf Kufhei. The Gemara tells us a story, and it's actually an interesting story. The Gemara says that Mar Ukva was one of the Amorai. Mar Ukva said about his father, also Rabbi Fine?
Yes.
Mar Ukva said about his father, is his class on Basar B'chalav?
Yes.
Okay. So this is just the recap. The quick version. 2.0. So Mar Ukva said, I am kechala bar chamra. I am like vinegar, the son of wine. What does it mean? Wine is very expensive. Vinegar is when you have wine that decomposes and rots, it turns into vinegar. So he says, my father was like wine. I am like vinegar. Nebuch, I'm like vinegar. How so? How do you see the contrast between my father and me, that he's like wine and I'm like vinegar? Says the Gemara, because my father, if he had meat today, he wouldn't have milk until tomorrow. He waited a whole day till he had the opposite gender, whatever you call it. The opposite meat and milk. He would wait a whole other day. What's the right way to say it? Gender, right? It's the only right way to say it. So he would wait a whole other day. And I am not like my father. Misuda sa lesuda afrina. I would only wait from one suuda till the next. So I wouldn't have meat and milk one after the other in the same meal, but I would wait from one meal to the next in order to separate between the eating of milk and the eating of meat. Okay. Now, first of all, did Rabbi Fine point this out? First of all, what does that mean? If, let's say, Shai Schefter says one day, I am like vinegar in compared to my father who's wine. How so? I can give you 5 million examples why I am like vinegar and he's like wine. Right? So one example would be he learns a lot and doesn't waste 1 second of his day, and I do. I waste plenty of time. Another example would be he's like a phenomenal Talmud Chacham, and like I don't have his brain and I don't have his hasmada. So there are a lot of examples you can give as to why you differentiate yourself from a great person. Things that are out of your league, correct? Now imagine I would say, I'm so different than my father. You know why? Because he wakes up 5 minutes early for davening every day, and I don't. I come to davening on time, but my father comes to davening 5 minutes early. Now, would that make sense for me to say that? Why not?
Just wake up 5 minutes early.
If you feel so uncomfortable about the fact that your father is so great and you're so little, that's a pretty easy thing to fix. Just say, oh, my father wakes up 5 minutes early to davening, and I really admire that. You know what? Set your alarm 5 minutes earlier and start going the same thing that he does. And that would clear the discrepancy between yourself and your father. So here we have Marukva who's saying, my father is such a great person, and I feel so inadequate in comparison to my father. How so? Because my father, when he has meat, he waits a whole day, 24 hours, to go have milk. And I only wait from one meal to the next. So be like your father and wait another day. What's the big deal? What's the big deal? So the answer that some Mefarshim explain is that Avodas Hashem in general, our service to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, has to be at the appropriate time and in the appropriate place and stage of our lives. Did Rabbi Fine talk about this? You can't just be, if your father waits 24 hours before he has milk, it's because that's where he's up to in his service and his relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're not there. For you to then skip to that would look ridiculous. Like the Gemara says in Maseches Sota, the Gemara gives a whole discussion about a Sota who comes to the Beis HaMikdash, and it says that we have to take off her head covering and we try to make her feel very uncomfortable. And then the Gemara wants to know, do we leave on her jewelry or not? So what do you say? Should you leave the jewelry on or not? Why not? So the Gemara says, on the one hand, the jewelry, like, oh, you look really fancy. So like, if we're trying to humiliate you, we would say, hey, take that fancy necklace off. On the other hand, says the Gemara, Gavra artiloi v'sayim esani. Imagine you have somebody who's running around the street naked. All they're wearing is boots and a necklace. You look at them, you say, you're insane. Right? It would be better if you left your necklace home also. You're insane. What are you doing? So says the Gemara, maybe that's part of what makes you look so silly is you're wearing something so fancy when you're wearing nothing. That doesn't match. So it's more humiliating to leave the jewelry on. It's like funny. So here also, that's the way they describe some Avodas Hashem. You're running around naked in the street. You've got nothing. You don't daven. You don't say brachos. You don't believe in HaKadosh Baruch, you don't have anything, but you're going to wait 24 hours till you have milchix. Like, really? That's the most important thing in your Judaism? That's where you're going to say, this is what we need to do? It doesn't fit you. It's not where you're up to in your life. So that's what my Rukva said. My father was such a holy person. He was at the level that when he ate meat, he would wait 24 hours until he would think about eating milk. Why don't I do the same thing? If I aspire to be like my father, the answer is, I'm not there yet. Maybe someday I'll get there. So I'm like vinegar compared to wine. That's what he said. You know, there's a comment of the Aruch Haim HaKadosh on last week's parsha. Lo sis Hashem Hashem Elokecha Lashav, which means you're not allowed to say the name of Hashem in vain. That's the simple understanding of the words. The Aruch Haim HaKadosh says, Lo sis Hashem Hashem Elokecha Lashav means don't carry the name of Hashem inappropriately. Don't walk around and make yourself as you have an appearance, an external, superficial appearance, as if I carry the name of Hashem Elokecha, but it's really Lashav, but really inside you don't feel anything, and it's not true, it doesn't match up with who you are. Says the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, what we feel inside has to be what we project outside as well. We have to be genuine people, sincere people, who really feel and believe the same thing. Now, of course, the Sefer Achinuch writes, Achar ha-pu'ulos nimshachim ha-levavos. Great question, Ayelet, right? So the Sefer Achinuch does say that sometimes it makes sense for a person to try to do something to make themselves ultimately feel that way. Yeah, that's true. But in general, he says, we have to be sincere people who really, really understand that our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our Avodas Hashem has to be something that is balanced, something that is appropriate, and something that is really where we're holding, where we're up to. Which, by the way, if you end up dating someone who is very imbalanced in what they project and what they say and how they act and how they behave, red flag. Red flag. Got it? If you date someone who is completely flipped out and not regulated and is really not stable in their religious observance, but is just on fire and doesn't really understand yet where they're going to land, red flag. Right? It has to be bahadraga. It has to be that a person is really up to that stage, and it doesn't always work so quickly. Sometimes we have very gradual growth, and that's okay. But we need to make sure that we don't fall in with someone who is not having a healthy balance of growth. Okay? Note to self. Okay. Now, every rabbinic institution, every takana derabbanan, needs a justification for why it came to be. Chazal, the Chacham, don't just have a right to get up one day and say, you know, let's make life difficult for the Jewish people. Ha. Let's figure out what can we come up with that will make it like more complicated. Have a great idea. Torah says you're not allowed to cook baser b'chalav and eat it. You know what? We're going to make life very difficult. You're not even allowed to have milk and meat in the same meal. What are you talking about? Imagine you lived in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, and he wakes up one day and he tells you, he'd be like, Moshe, excuse me. Like, I was there when God gave us the Torah. I heard what he said. That's not what he said. So what's this all about? Where did it come from? Where did this idea come from that we expand the whole definition of Lo Tavashal Gedi B'Chalev Imo to also mean that you're not allowed to have meat and milk together even if they were not cooked with one another? That is a big machlokas between Rashi, who lived in, passed away in 1105, and the Rambam, who lived a little bit after Rashi. The Rambam passed away in 1204, so they were like 100 years apart. So the Rashi and the Rambam have a dispute as to explain why it is that there was a concern. Why are you not allowed to eat meat and milk one after the other? What's the problem? Rashi says because the concern is that basar hashuman is going to be nidbak bepeh. When you eat meat, usually the assumption is that it's going to linger in your mouth. And even though you're no longer chewing it, you're no longer consuming it, we assume that that taste can linger on for a long time. And then when you're going to eat milk later on, perhaps in your mouth or in your swallowing process, you're going to then have the mixed tastes with one another. The Rambam disagrees, and the Rambam says, no, the concern is basar bein hashinayim. The concern is that meat sometimes will get stuck in between your teeth. And therefore, says the Rambam, the concern is going to be if that happens, that then if you subsequently are going to eat something that is dairy, you are going to then mix it up in your mouth together with that which is stuck in between your teeth. And therefore, we assume that that potentially should be a problem. The Shmir Shabbos Gilchasa has a very interesting question, where he says, if you assume that there's a concern of basar ben ashinayim, that after somebody eats meat, maybe it's going to be stuck in their teeth, I have a question for you. Let's say you have very misaligned teeth, and you never had braces. So you have a big space in between your teeth in the front, right? So on Shabbos, you want to go outside, and you take a... You know, you have no Erev outside, so you take something and you put it in between your teeth and you walk outside with it. You're in violation of Malacha? You say no. Why? Because in Chicago they have an Erev. Okay, but what about here? You don't have an Erev.
It's not the normal way of caring.
Okay, but it could be Hotzah, right? It could be Hotzah because you are carrying something outside, right? So it would be Malacha Derabbanan, let's say. So he says, if the Rambam is really concerned that anyone who eats meat may have it stuck in between your teeth, says the Shmir Shabbos Kachasa, then maybe every time someone eats meat on Shabbos, they should have to floss before they go outside. If you have an Erev, there's no concern. But if you have no Erev, would we say that somebody has to floss before they go outside on Shabbos? No. It's a good idea to floss anyway. Not good to have things stuck in your teeth. But would you have an obligation on Shabbos to floss or use a toothpick before you go outside to make sure there's no meat stuck between your teeth? Very interesting question. Interesting question. No, Amanda?
I think it's like plaque also.
What?
But like plaque on your teeth.
Plaque on your teeth. So I wouldn't call that hotzah. Right, that's
you
like
you don't want it there.
Right, you don't want it there. I don't think you want the meat here either. Okay, so these are the reasons where we find in the Rishonim as to why this prohibition came to be. Would there be any nafkamina? Would there be any difference between reason A and reason B? The reason of Rashi is because it lingers in your mouth. The reason of the Rambam is because it's going to get stuck in your teeth. One nafkamina would be something that nauseates me every time I see it in the poskim. They say, Elois basar letinok. Let's say you have a young child, and the child cannot eat meat that is coarse. So what does the parent do? Not in my house. But in the days of the poskim, apparently, the parent used to chew the piece of meat and then give it to the child to eat. You ever heard of such a thing? Your aunt? No? Right? So, I'm joking. So if you chew the piece of meat and then give it to a child, would I then be allowed to have milk afterward? Now, I didn't swallow it, so the taste is not going to linger in my mouth. But at the same time, I did chew it. As I was chewing it, it may have gotten stuck in my teeth. So that, they say, would be one distinction where we would draw this difference between Rashi and the Rambam. Another difference would be, let's say, for example, let's say you have hard cheese. So hard cheese leaves over a taste in your mouth also the same way that meat leaves over a taste in your mouth. But hard cheese doesn't get stuck in your teeth. It's soft, right? I mean, hard cheese is soft. No? Yeah. So the question is, why would there be any prohibition of having meat within 6 hours of eating hard cheese? That would depend on this. So the Shulchan Aruch says, because it is a machlokes, the Rashi and the Rambam, and both opinions seem to be very valid and based on something that makes sense, therefore the Shulchan Aruch says we have to be machmir for both points. We have to be machmir in both directions. And we need to say that both reasons apply. The reason you shouldn't have meat and then milk subsequently right after is because, number one, we're concerned maybe the meat is going to be stuck in your teeth. Number two, because we're concerned that maybe the taste is going to linger. And because of that, that's what we assume, that that is going to spill over to hard cheeses as well. If you're going to have a hard cheese, then it may linger in your mouth. And then to have meat within 6 hours after that would potentially be a problem. Now, I'm saying 6 hours as if that is the given. How many in the room wait 6 hours after having meat? Okay. Those that didn't raise their hands, what do you wait? 5 hours. Okay, what else?
It's very new.
Into the sixth, okay. Anybody else? Nobody waits one? Three hours? Okay. So what is this, arbitrary? Like everybody, what's going on here? So the truth is, this is a major machlokas harishonim. How do you understand when Mar Ukva said, my father didn't used to eat meat and milk together, he would wait a whole day, but I only wait from one suda to another? Tosis writes on the daf there, Maseches Chulin daf Kufei, that he takes it very literally. And he says that it means that all you have to do is bench, take a little mouthwash, wash out your mouth, and then you can go to the next meal. That's what Maruk was said, as long as you don't eat them at the same meal. Anybody here does that? So nobody does that. The minimum that people wait is 1 hour. Why did they wait 1 hour? That's based on the comment of the Zohar. Very good. The comment of the Zohar. The Bir Agra, the Vilna Gaon quotes from the Zohar. Bir Agra is on Shulchan Aruch. He quotes from the Zohar that he said you have to wait Kechada Shata. Kechada Shata means 1 hour. So the bare minimum that you have to wait is 1 hour. Everything beyond that is considered to be a chumrah. And that is why it is very clear in the poskim that if you have a chola, if you have someone who's not feeling well, or if you have a katan, you have a child who wants to have ice cream, we're not going to start fighting with the kid and say, oh no, you have to wait 6 hours. You say, after 1 hour, you would allow the child to have the ice cream. Now, for chinuch purposes, as the child grows older, we should probably explain to them the whole reasoning behind all this and what it's all about. But the bare minimum that one is supposed to wait would be 1 hour, and therefore it says the Chasam Sofer, if someone has a stomachache and they need, he writes that if someone has a stomachache and they need milk, I think now they say if someone has a stomachache they shouldn't drink milk, right? So he says if someone needs milk to line their stomach, acid, reflux, whatever it is, and they have to drink some milk, so he says, if your life is in danger, then you have to do whatever you have to do. But he says if your life is not in danger, but you're just not comfortable, then we would tell someone after 1 hour they should have no concerns at all, and it would be okay. But what's with the 3 hours? And what's with the 5 hours? What's with the 6 hours? What's this all about? So the way the post can basically explain it is when the Gemara says that we wait between one Suda and another, the question is, which part of the world do you live in? Some places in the world they used to have 4 meals a day. Some places in the world they used to have 2 meals a day. So they used to wait X amount of hours in between meals. And the question here is, when the Gemara says you have to wait Misuda Lasuda, the question is, what exactly does that mean? Does it mean from the amount of time that people used to wait in their communities from one meal to the next? Or does it mean, like the Bali Atosa say, just wash and bench and that's it and that's good enough, and even 5 minutes later would be fine? This is where the origin of that whole discrepancy comes from, of many of our families have different minhagim. The Ramah actually says that minhag Ashkenaz was to wait 1 hour. So for those who make fun of a person who only waits 1 hour, it's the Ramah. The Ramah himself says that in Kehilas Ashkenaz, in many of the Ashkenazi communities, they only waited 1 hour. He quotes that from the Maharil, and that is why it's a very legitimate opinion. Now, many do not follow that, but many who come from German descent do that, because that was the practice. However, even that being said, the Ramah writes, and the Maharshal and the Shach all write, that Misha Yesh Bo Reach Torah, someone who has Yira Shamayim, someone who's careful about things, will also be careful to make sure to wait 6 hours. Even if your family practice happens to be that you only wait 1 hour, the Ramah says that the custom has developed in many, many communities that we wait longer, we wait 6 hours. I know it's not so easy, but that is what the Ramah suggests would be the right thing to do. And that is what many, many people do. Even if you come from German descent, that is what many people have taken upon themselves to do regardless. I see that we are out of time. I'll just mention one final point to think about, and that is, have you ever been at a meal and somebody looks at their watch in the middle of the Shabbos meal and says, okay, we finished eating the challenge at whatever, tonight we could have pizza. I'm not the only one where this happens, right? Tonight we could have pizza at X time. The problem is everyone sits around the table for the next 45 minutes and schmoozes until they bench and we have dessert. So do you wait from the time that the meal is over or from the time that you finished having the meat? That is a big, big discussion in the poskim. It seems that the overwhelming majority of the poskim, Kaf HaChaim and the Darkei Tshuva and the Dagon Mervava and the Badei HaShulchan and many of the contemporary poskim say that you only have to wait from the time that you finish having the meat. You don't have to wait from the time that you bench. So it does make sense to look at your watch. Again, I don't see the urgency in having pizza the minute that Shabbos is over. I just spoke to someone who came back from a cruise. They were on a cruise in winter vacation. And they said they wrote down all of the different issues that they want me to talk about in subsequent series of Shiurim for someone who goes on a cruise. And there were so many issues, I can't even begin to have Shiurim on this. I think it's too complicated. But a lot of things to think about. So they said, but, you know, there was a pizza oven that was making pizza on Shabbos. So they thought this was very strange. How can you make pizza on Shabbos? No. So they said a lot of the frum people were going upstairs and getting the fresh pizza on Shabbos. So they went over to the tour operator who's frum, and they asked him, how do you have fresh pizza for a Shabbos meal? How does that work? He said, no. What do you mean? We cook the pizza before Shabbos. We just heat it up. But, well, how do you put it in the pizza oven on Shabbos? And how much did you cook it? Right, the cheese is now melting. The cheese didn't melt yesterday, so it's like, no, it's bishul achar bishul, because the cheese really was cooked beforehand, before whatever. Whole story. Incorrect, but okay. So this woman told me, we weren't comfortable getting pizza on Shabbos because it just doesn't seem right, and nothing about it seemed correct. But I then asked this woman, what hashkacha is this person under? She's like, I don't know, come to think of it. I'm not sure. Just heard that there was a Jewish tour operator on a cruise, so we went. I'm like, what? Okay. Anyway, so she told me the good news was that the second Shabbos was over, my kids didn't have to wait on a line to get pizza because everyone ate the pizza on Shabbos already. So my kids, when you go to the pizza store after Shabbos, you have to wait, I don't know how long you have to wait. Really? 1 hour. Here they didn't have to wait 1 hour. You were able to have the pizza after Shabbos the second Shabbos was over. Amazing. I said, how about the fact that all this was prepared on Shabbos? All right, another issue to think about. But yes, most of the poskim say that you would be able to have meat and milk within 6 hours of the meat, as long as you waited 6 hours from the time that you finished having the meat, and it doesn't necessarily have to be from the end of the suit. Okay?